From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, the Trump administration's new guidelines for the Title X funding program prompts a lawsuit from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin.
It's just one more attempt that we have seen under this administration to deny individuals access to information and providers and services based on an ideological agenda.
Later, a Milwaukee researcher explores the influence of motherhood over the years.
We'll talk with film contributor Dave Lurson about Avengers: Infinity War.
And writer Denise Kiernan explains why she was so intrigued by the colossal Biltmore Estate Mansion in North Carolina.
I became really curious, not just about, you know, the house and its size, but who had lived there, who had made this place what it was, and how did it still possibly manage to exist?
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin recently filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over its Title X funding announcement.
Title X is a federal grant program that provides funding for reproductive health care for underinsured and uninsured people. The Trump administration's new guidelines for the program prioritize abstinence counseling and natural family planning methods over comprehensive contraceptive services.
Kinsey Hosted is a senior policy manager with the Guttmacher Institute's D.C. office. It's a nonpartisan pro-choice institution that provides research and informs discussion on reproductive health and rights.
Hosted spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about how the new announcement may change the program.
First of all, it came months behind schedule, which really had put a lot of folks in who are currently Title X grantees and really the entire publicly funded family planning safety net kind of into a little bit of, they were quite worried. Because normally a funding announcement comes out and then allows applicants and entities a number of months to apply for those grants and then plan for their coming fiscal years. So the Trump administration's funding announcement was forecasted to come out last October, and it was not actually released until February of this year, so many months behind schedule, which I think is indicative of some of the chaos that we have seen under the Trump administration, and particularly in the Department of Health and Human Services. But one of the reasons a lot of us were concerned that it had been delayed was because the Trump administration was trying to use this funding announcement as a vehicle to push a number of longstanding socially conservative priorities. And in fact, when the funding announcement was released at the end of February, that's what we saw.
What are some of those socially conservative priorities that you see in the announcement?
First, the funding announcement was opening the door for the administration to kind of reshape the network of providers supported by Title X dollars. Second, it promotes natural family planning, otherwise known as fertility awareness-based methods, which is one particular type of contraceptive method over people's access to the broad range of contraceptive options. Third, it really advances abstinence only until marriage messages for adolescents, but also for all Title X clients. And fourth, it seems to indicate the possibility that the administration might interfere with people's ability to obtain family planning services confidentially, which is particularly concerning because confidentiality has always been a hallmark of Title X supported services.
And so this lawsuit that Planned Parenthood is bringing, I talked to a representative from Planned Parenthood, and they're indicating that one of the main basis for the lawsuit is the fact that it's almost changing the intent of the statute without going through Congress and without that sort of thing. Do you agree with that?
You know, I think I will steer clear of commenting on the lawsuits in particular, but
oh, okay.
I think it seems clear to us that the Trump administration is prioritizing changing the intent and the impact of the Title X program. And you know, these changes that it is proposing through this funding announcement are quite drastic and notable and deeply concerning. They seem to be indicating a shift away from the Title X program's main reason for being, which is to ensure that low-income and otherwise underserved communities in this country are able to, and individuals are able to access the family planning care that they need. And in a funding announcement that's really prioritizing ideology over public health and opening the door to totally reshaping the program and the services that it supports.
What would you say to organizations that say that changes are good because they take away money from Planned Parenthood or other organizations that offer abortion services?
I think the first thing I would say is that Title X funds do not support abortion services, period. You know, the statute that established the Title X program and the regulations that implement it have made clear that no Title X dollars go to support abortion services. So that's been true since the program's inception. It is also very clearly legal for sites that receive Title X dollars to support family planning services to also offer abortion using non-federal funds. And so, you know, I think that that is a deeply flawed argument. And these dollars have never gone toward abortion services. And they're, when we are talking about the type of sites who might offer abortion in addition to family planning care, we're probably and most often talking about sites that focus on the provision of reproductive health services. And this includes, but is not limited to, Planned Parenthood. And the idea of trying to exclude these types of providers from Title X is deeply worrisome, as these providers often provide very high quality contraceptive care, which makes sense, right? Because this is the work that they have focused on. And they're also often able to see large numbers of contraceptive clients, helping them to meet the need for these services in their communities.
How do your 2015 statistics shed light on what would happen if the Trump administration changes funding to organizations like Planned Parenthood?
In talking about excluding providers that really focus on reproductive health, including Planned Parenthood, from these publicly funded programs, we're talking about impacting a lot of clients. We see that the average Title X funded Planned Parenthood health center serves 3,200 contraceptive clients every year. And the next closest type of provider might be a hospital site that receives Title X funding that serves about 1,100 clients per year. So these types of providers just are able to see so many more people who are seeking these services than other types of providers. So that's why if you go, then looking back to Wisconsin in particular, our 2015 data shows that Title X supported Planned Parenthood health centers in Wisconsin served more than 24,000 clients that year, which accounts for about 80% of all the Title X contraceptive clients seen in Wisconsin in 2015.
Do you think that this guideline changes are going to change the type of contraceptive services that individuals get through Title X?
I think that it threatens to do so. It's impossible to know quite yet. I think there are a number of things yet to be seen. You know, entities and agencies around the country are working really hard right now on their applications for Title X grants for the coming fiscal year. Those applications are due at the end of May. And so not only will we have to see, you know, who actually winds up applying, but also who is actually granted Title X funding and how that will shape the network of providers and the scope of services supported by the program. And that's all in addition to seeing how, you know, the lawsuit turns out. But I think under the current funding opportunity announcement as issued by the Trump administration, it certainly stands to threaten people's access to affordable and high quality contraceptive care across the country, including in Wisconsin. It's deeply troubling that instead of elevating and advancing the standards of high quality family planning care that the funding announcement as issued does emphasize these natural family planning methods over all others. And I think the emphasis on abstinence only until marriage messages and counseling for all Title X clients is, again, deeply troubling. You know, the programmatic guidelines and the standard of care that have been advanced for Title X clients under previous administrations really advance a patient-centered standard of care. And what we have seen from the Trump administration so far with this funding announcement is quite directive and, you know, seems to us to be yet another step in a coercive anti-sexual and reproductive health and rights agenda from the Trump administration. It's just one more attempt that we have seen under this administration to deny individuals access to information and providers and services based on an ideological agenda.
Did you hear about the terminology, like return to a sexually risk-free status that the Health and Human Services have been using?
Yes, very much so. Which I think, you know, we have seen that in other places as well. That's not unique to Title X. We have Valerie Huber, who is the woman, the political appointee currently in charge of the Title X program. Previously was with a large national abstinence only until marriage advocacy organization. And so I think we have been aware of the possibility that these kinds of messages would make their way into different programs, particularly with her leadership. And so the funding announcement, as you say, really urges providers to communicate abstinence only until marriage messages, but it uses coded language like avoiding sexual risk or returning to a sexually risk-free status. And actually, this language is now actually quite common among abstinence-only proponents, including Valerie Huber's prior organization. And they are all using this as part of an attempt to rebrand their agenda.
Tell me about how the guidelines address natural family planning methods as birth control.
You know, the funding announcement repeatedly emphasizes the need for providers to offer fertility awareness-based methods or natural family planning methods. And that implies that, as things stand, these types of methods are not sufficiently available to Title X clients, when this just isn't the case. These methods have always been part of the broad range of contraceptive methods supported by Title X, and they're actually explicitly mentioned in the Title X statute and regulations. So I think there has never been a question that these methods are an important part of Title X. But what is critically important is that they remain one of a broad range of options that every single client has the ability to learn about and choose from. You know, we do know that relatively small proportions of Title X clients and women using contraception nationwide choose these types of methods. So they are important. And for women and couples for whom these methods work, they absolutely need to have access to them and be able to use them successfully. But for most women in Title X clients, these are not the methods that they turn to. They're looking to other methods. And so Title X sites, particularly as those dedicated to providing really high quality family planning care, need to be able to offer, again, all clients a broad range of methods and help them start to use those methods quickly and successfully.
Kinsey Hested, thank you so much for speaking about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kinsey Hested is a senior policy manager with the Guttmacher Institute's Washington, D.C. office. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver.
A short break now, and then a researcher explores the powerful rhetoric of mothers through the years. We'll find out what she's learned when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Mother's Day is Sunday, and while it's a time where we traditionally give thought to the influence our own mothers have had on our lives, a UW-Milwaukee researcher is studying the broader impact of motherhood.
Leslie Harris is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at UW-Milwaukee. She's also president of the Organization for Research on Women and Communication. She joins us in the studio to talk about how motherhood has shaped our society. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So what are the lenses through which motherhood shows up in your research?
Whenever you're looking at women in public culture and the ways in which women try to engage in public culture, you almost inevitably come across motherhood as a really important theme in things that you're seeing. So some people end up using motherhood as a resource for action. Sometimes motherhood is a necessary limitation to what people are doing. So why are you doing this if you're a mother? Or mothers can't do this sort of thing, or good mothers behave in this way. And sometimes motherhood is the site of things that people are trying to change.
Is motherhood ever used as kind of, to use a very modern term, street cred? I can do this because I am a mother, or these people can do this because they are mothers?
Yeah, there's a long history of women justifying public action because of motherhood. So even during the Revolutionary era in the United States, women's public identity was around this identity of mother, that they're supposed to raise good citizens in order to shape the new country. But then during the Civil War, women used motherhood as a justification for anti-slavery activism. Going into the 19th and 20th centuries, women have used motherhood as justification to act to prevent drunk driving, to reduce gun violence, all sorts of different public actions that might seem uncomfortable or even taboo become possible under this lens of motherhood. Because after all, what else are women supposed to do other than protect their kids?
Right. So I was going to ask, as I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking of famous mothers throughout history, and thinking about the role of the First Lady. And in a lot of ways, it feels like we might think of her sometimes as not just the wife of the president, but as the first mother.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Women sometimes, especially public women, become emblematic of what people are supposed to do in the way that they're supposed to behave. So sometimes we follow the First Lady's lead in things that are acceptable behaviors or good behaviors. But sometimes First Ladies become targets of criticism because they're in such a prominent public position.
At what point do women learn that motherhood might give them access to public discourse and influence in public policy in a way that other aspects to their womanhood do not?
I think there are a few parts of it. The first is that not all biological mothers it's not only biological mothers that use motherhood as a tool for action. So a lot of people, especially women, can draw on this idea of motherhood in order to justify public action. So some of the most famous people during their time were active kind of as mothers, even though they weren't biological mothers. So if we look into like the 1880s and 1890s, Frances Willard was the most famous woman of her time, incredibly influential, and she ran the largest political women's organization in the country, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And she organized women around this banner of home protection. As mothers, women need to organize to protect their kids. And they even celebrated a Mother's Day in January during the winter in celebration of Frances Willard's own mother. So there, it's an example of women organizing even if they're around this idea of motherhood, even if they're not biological mothers. But right now, we see a lot of women who notice problems in the world a new way because of their connection to their own motherhood and their relationship with their own children. And even talking to a lot of women, they don't see themselves as particularly political, but they know or they see one of their primary jobs as particularly protecting their own kids and other people's kids. And that realization can become a moment of action for a lot of people.
This is the term that people have started using in the last 10, 15 years of the mama bear.
Yeah, and the mama bear, that language might be more recent, but it's an idea that has a really long history in the United States.
Well, so let's go back a long way, you know, more than 150 years here, because you have written about the role of motherhood as it pertains to anti-slavery activism. How was motherhood a factor in making a difference in changing attitudes towards slavery?
Well, a lot of women, especially women in the North, may not have felt personally connected to slavery, but for many of them, they felt there was something wrong and they needed some way to act, and a tool for action and a justification to act in a world where women were not really supposed to be public and political. And so a lot of women organized around the idea of motherhood, and they can see a commonality between their motherhood and the motherhood of women who were enslaved, who were trying to be mothers and their children were taken away from them, or they didn't have the capability to be good mothers because they were enslaved. And so women in the North, primarily white women in the North, drew on this idea of motherhood to unify people to act, but to also create a sense of empathy and identification with women who seemed so different than themselves.
And they did this through magazines, I guess?
Yeah. One really common form was gift books. So the Liberty Bell is one gift book where authors and nonfiction, fiction, poetry would all be assembled in a book that was ultimately sold in order to promote the anti-slavery cause. And these would be like coffee table books. And some were sold at a higher price, some were sold at a lower price, and it disseminated this message. Sometimes these same messages were also in pamphlets. It might have been in popular literature during the time, published in magazines or newspapers as well.
Of course, at this point, women do not have the vote. And so the hope is that women, by being united, would influence the men in their lives?
Absolutely. So the vote is just one form of public engagement. And in some ways, it's really important, right? But women didn't have the right to vote until 1920, at least all across the United States. And so the ability to harness language and rhetoric to influence public opinion and to change the shape of the public conversation was incredibly important, especially since they didn't have that institutional resource. But even after the vote, women's public influence was very much tied to their ability to harness language and rhetoric and shape the ability for us to talk about something in very specific ways. And that can extend an individual's power beyond that just one vote that they have.
What were some of the other key examples along the way of how the power of motherhood and the rhetoric of motherhood made a difference in public policy?
So the Women's Christian Temperance Union is probably the most significant example. Now, this was in the 1880s and 1890s, the single largest women's organization in the United States and probably the rest of the world as well. And here, women organized under this banner of temperance, keeping alcohol out of the home. And ultimately, they pushed for the Prohibition Amendment. But their idea was that they needed to organize to protect the home because there was significant problems with domestic abuse. Women didn't have control of their own property or money in the home. And so they felt that focusing on this issue could help them become better mothers and protect the home. And so motherhood became an organizing mechanism during that movement. But it also came up in peace movements. So Julia Ward Howe, for example, established the first or one of the first Mother's Days for Peace, which was an organized movement to promote world peace, an anti-war organization, but specifically focusing on the role that mothers had in maintaining peace under this assumption that women are peaceful, they're loving, and if you can harness that love, then everybody can get along.
Did the rhetoric of motherhood ever come into conflict with other women's issues? I mean, I'm thinking about the Equal Rights Amendments.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think about the rhetoric of motherhood, we have a set of cultural expectations, and those cultural expectations are both limiting and empowering. So the idea that mothers nurture and care for children, that they're loving, that they can do it all, that they can be in every place and do everything really well, those are all limitations that individual women have to grapple with, but also that people use in public culture to suggest that women shouldn't be doing certain things. So women running for public office are often asked, well, who's watching your kids? And of course, in the debate over the ERA, there was a significant debate about whether women really needed this Equal Rights Amendment because women should be different. They should be honored. They should be separate. And they should really be focused on their kids. So motherhood is always a double-edged sword.
Leslie Harris is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at UW-Milwaukee and president of the Organization for Research on Women and Communication. You can read more about her research on motherhood at wuwm.com.
Another quick break, and then film contributor Dave Lurson shares his view of Avengers: Infinity War. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Unless you've been living under a rock, you've probably heard that the 19th installment in the Marvel Universe is on screens around the world. Avengers: Infinity War recently became the fastest movie to earn $1 billion.
It is jam-packed with everyone's favorite superheroes, from Iron Man to Captain America to Black Panther. But do those epic proportions work to the advantage or the detriment of the story at the heart of the film? Film contributor Dave Lurson joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and talked about his favorite Avenger and whether that character got their due in the new film.
I think one of my favorites of the Avengers, Robert Downey Jr., Iron Man, Tony Stark. He got a lot of screenplay. I think that was great. My other favorite, Black Panther, Chadwick Boseman. We don't really see him until, would it be the last quarter of the movie, maybe?
Probably, yeah. Last 40 minutes or so.
Well, I mean, it makes sense for him to pop up at that point during the movie, so I can't really begrudge that. I love Benedict Cumberbatch, and he arrives with a character, Doctor Strange, familiar to comic book fans. Not a whole lot of character development there, I'm afraid, but maybe we'll at some point see more of him and explore the world of Doctor Strange a little bit.
With this movie, every superhero introduced, or I don't think there were any new introductions necessarily in this film, but they are all packed into one, although they are all kind of separated on different universes. But one thing that this movie shows is that this is truly a Marvel universe. You know, most times it has taken place on planet Earth, mm-hmm. for the most part. But here we are seeing interdimensional battles and fights. And it's very obviously heavily CGI'd. I imagine there's a lot of green screen acting mm-hmm. going on with this. Do you think that takes away from the impact of a Marvel universe?
Well, I think they're taking this universe thing very literally. We've been, as a manner of speaking, people have been talking about the DC universe and the Marvel universe, and now we have a movie that encompasses or tries to encompass the universe with various planets and dimensions and armies of characters arrayed against the evil supervillain here. I found the movie to be a bit crowded, overly long, and not enough, character development, for lack of a better term, for the characters in there. There were too many of them for my taste. Acting in front of a green screen to pick up that train of thought it can be done, but...
Do you feel like the human chemistry was suffered in such a stylized production?
There wasn't enough human chemistry. There was some. Honestly, but I think if there had been a tight handful of characters working together in this, it would have worked better on that level. So I had some, moments of displeasure with it. I mean, I guess the thing that I disliked about the movie, the many things I liked about it, but the thing I disliked is the thing I tend to dislike about most recent superhero movies, whether DC or Marvel or whatever universe they may be coming from, is the reliance on too many of these set-piece, computer-generated battle scenes, which just go on and on. It's as if they're trying to top the previous scene or top the previous movie coming out of this universe. And there were a few good special effects moments, I thought, in this movie. Many of them connected with Doctor Strange. I thought that the visualization of what he was doing was sometimes quite good. But, you know, I would love it to put out a challenge to superhero movie directors. Can we have a superhero movie in the 21st century without computer-generated imagery of any kind? Can we figure out how to do that? And by doing that, I think you would actually be able to explore the human dimension of the characters, more so because you might have to rely on that to carry the film.
Yeah, I agree. One of my follow-up questions was, is it too much action to be impactful? Because before I saw that, I heard, oh, great action sequence, back to back to back, you know, where you have those whoa moments. But for me, it was all too much that it kind of blended into one massive action scene.
Right. I can't really pick apart in memory now, you know, very many aspects of it, one from the other. Again, I would like to have heard more from Thanos, the evil character, mm-hmm. you know, getting into his philosophy or ideology a little bit more. And there's a touch of that in the movie. Again, there are ideas floating around in here, but they tend to get lost or overlooked amidst this conglomeration and blur of hurling people across entire planets, you know, smashing up entire worlds. You know, it's I guess we can do it. We have the technology, but does that mean we should do it? It's an eternal question.
Well, and another thing is that this story arc with Thanos, it has been originally done over many, many comics, and you have a bit more character development and the power of storytelling over a period of time in written form. But here they're trying to stretch or smash, I suppose you could say, into two movies. And I do think that Thanos is a good villain. Like, there is a strength to him compared to other Marvel movie villains where their main goal is to destroy the Earth. This goes much bigger.
Yeah, Thanos, not unlike Hitler, Mao, Pol Pot, I mean, a number of people of this kind in real life, has an idea. I mean, he thinks that what he's doing is beneficial. He is willing to, he's an ends justify the means kind of a person, you could say that. And if the means involve mass murder on a planetary, even galactic scale, and the end result is a peaceful, benign cosmos, well, fine. He's willing to do that. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the comic book Thanos, as it has been developed over the years, was trying to get at some of these ideas. And the movie, yeah, we hear that, but I think it's easy to lose sight of who he is.
Yeah, the theme or the attempted theme is to be darker. Do you think it succeeded in this?
I don't know what we're going to do about spoiler alerts here, although I suppose that everybody who really cares sort of knows how the
probably
movie
probably has already
ends.
Seen. Well, yes. We won't name names.
We won't name names, but
spoiler alert, there are character deaths.
Well, yeah. I mean, the movie ends on a very dark note. I'm going to put it that way. And, I have every expectation that somehow this will all resolve itself in part two of this movie in 2 years' time. And we may very well see a rematch, another second Armageddon, if that's possible. And, you know, will Thanos be defeated at that point? I mean, one imagines so. But, you know, I guess you could say the movie Infinity War does point out that good doesn't always win. Something we need to keep in mind, however we define good, doesn't always win. Sometimes the bad guys do get the upper hand. And, yeah, is that a sophisticated message for the world we live in? Yeah, I guess we need to internalize that.
Did you feel that with the ending and with so many character deaths that it was as impactful? Because in my mind, I'm like, well, they can't kill that many. They're just going to come back.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I point out in something I wrote about this, there will be no resurrections this time. I think Thanos' word. Well, I don't believe him. I think that, you know, going all the way back to Arthur Conan Doyle trying to kill off Sherlock Holmes back in 1890, whenever that was, and he was forced to find a way to bring Sherlock Holmes back again after his apparent death. I mean, I guess I don't believe it when somebody tells me that a popular character is dead and gone, because even if the author really wants to kill the character and move on to other things, popular demand, will insist that this character come back again.
Well, and with the Marvel Universe, it just seems that more leads to more.
Mm-hmm. More leads. Well, I like more leading to less. I mean, I think it'd be great if in the next movie of this sort, the Avengers Infinity War 2 or whatever it's going to be called, that maybe we have, and I'll just pick my, you know, my favorite characters, Hulk, Black Panther, Doctor Strange, and Iron Man, maybe the four of them. And actually, you know, the Scarlet...
Scarlet Witch?
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Olsen is the most interesting female character in the movie. I guess I would like to learn more about her story. I'd like to see more about her.
I'd like to see where her accent went.
Right, right. So, yeah, so maybe we could limit the next movie to five of these characters and just learn more, know more about them, see where they're coming from a little bit more.
Yeah, and the, well, obviously intentional thing is that we are actually back to the core Avengers mm-hmm. by the end of this. So do you think the vastness of the Marvel Universe, of this particular movie and the part two to come, does its vastness narrow the parameters of criticism? Because people go into this thinking, oh, well, it's a Marvel movie, so there will be some things that you'll like, there will be some things you don't like. But do you feel that no matter what, I mean, it's already surpassed the billion mark in record time?
Critic-proof is the term for yeah, it doesn't matter, you know, whether I like or dislike it, whether A.O. Scott from the New York Times likes it or dislikes it, or... anybody else in the world, you know, somebody with a Facebook page with 3 billion friends likes it or dislikes it. In that sense, it really doesn't matter. I think that the only useful thing a critic can do is to, you know, sort through the movie, unpack it a little bit, and try to determine what the movie is telling us about our world, about our society, about the mood of today. And I guess maybe one thing is the mood of today is kind of dark.
Well, I'm sure we will be discussing many more Marvel movies to come in
the
studio.
There will be many more.
Yes. Well, thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express newspaper and one of our regular film contributors. He talked with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about Avengers Infinity War.
One more break, and then we travel through a new book to North Carolina and the iconic Biltmore Estate. Come with us as Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. There are some notable addresses and iconic homes around the United States, but one has stood the test of time and remains the largest home on U.S. soil. The Biltmore Estate, built in the late 19th century in Asheville, North Carolina, is a colossal mansion built by George Vanderbilt.
The 175,000-square-foot home features 250 rooms, including 35 bedrooms and 45 bathrooms, so there is never a wait for the shower. It is the stuff of legend, as is the story of the people who built and lived in it. Both are chronicled in a new book by Denise Kiernan called The Last Castle. She dropped by the Lake Effect studio during a recent tour and talked with Audrey Nowakowski about what first led her to write about this oversized home.
The first time I went, I was actually 14 years old. My dad was stationed in South Carolina. My mom said, let's go see this historic house for the weekend. Most 14-year-olds would roll their eyes at that, but I was a little history nerd. So I heard that and I was like, yes, let's go see a historic house. When I was 14, Biltmore was quite different and a little more mellow, but still, I mean, stunning. And I felt like I was stepping back in time when I walked into the house. So many of the family's furnishings are there, tapestries, all these sorts of things. It was really, really immersive. But I never thought I'd be back in Asheville again. Cut to 12 years ago, and I'm living in Asheville. And one of the first things I decide to do is go to Biltmore House with my Jersey husband, who didn't even know what Biltmore House was, and I hadn't been in ages. And the two of us went together, and now as an adult who writes, I became really curious, not just about, you know, the house and its size, but who had lived there, who had made this place what it was, and how did it still possibly manage to exist?
Right. And there is a lot of history with this house, not just with its original owner, conceptualizer, but his family history, his wife's family history. And it's a lot of primary documents, I imagine. So what kind of research did you rummage through, and how difficult was it for you to kind of make a blueprint for this book?
Well, I write all sorts of stuff. I started out in journalism. I enjoy screenwriting. I enjoy fiction, but narrative nonfiction is my thing. And I could just stay locked in archives for hours and be happy as a clam. For this particular book, I consulted many, many different archives. And for anybody who's curious at looking at that sort of stuff themselves, you can find them all in the back of the book. Two of my most significant troves were, first, the New York Public Library Manuscript and Archives Division. That had the papers of William B. Osgood Field, one of George's best friends, and Paul Lester Ford, noted and often unknown novelist, Paul Lester Ford, whose life was sadly cut short, also a very dear friend of George. Their family members as well had papers there. That provided Field's diaries alone for he and George's travels before George got married to Edith. And as George was beginning his engagement to Edith, that was spectacular. And, you know, of course, when somebody writes someone a letter, their thoughts and feelings, their letters are often in that person's archive. So there were just the most wonderful, affectionate letters from George to Field and to Ford and to Ford's relatives on different occasions, whether it be, you know, the birth of the daughter or marriage, all of these sorts of wonderful things. Then at the Hay Library archives at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, Edith's sister, Natalie, who married John Brown, the Brown family, extremely established in Rhode Island, her papers are there, as well as her husband's and her son's. And that had a tremendous amount of family information about Edith, including when they were all just young, unmarried women. Edith was one of the main inspirations for wanting to do this book, and that for me was spectacular. I mean, I actually start the book with Edith Stuyvesant Dresser, who went on to be Edith Vanderbilt, married to George and mistress of Biltmore House. I wanted to show her as an independent woman, as a single woman, as a young woman, before she simply became a married woman, you know, married to Mrs. George Vanderbilt. And being able to sort of really get a feeling for who she was made a huge, huge difference for me.
I do want to get back to Edith soon, but before we touch upon that, I want to talk about the Gilded Age. You know, it's post-Civil War, not quite industrialization. America's kind of in this limbo transitional period, and you definitely have the haves and the have-nots. And, of course, George Vanderbilt came upon his money through his family, his grandfather, their businesses. And, you know, in the book, there's a quote, "The rich sought to conquer one another on battlefields of architectural grandeur." So what do you think set George Vanderbilt apart from his fellow American aristocrats?
Yeah, so when you think about what brought George to the Asheville area of North Carolina, I think there are a lot of things that go into it. So he's the grandson of the Commodore, Cornelius Vanderbilt, the founder of the family fortune. George's father, William Henry, doubled his inheritance and was considered at the time to be possibly the richest man in the world. George was William Henry's youngest child. George's older brothers were all interested in going into the shipping and railroad business. George was not. Like you said, he wanted to read his books. He wanted to go to concerts. He wanted to listen to music. He wanted to travel, collect art, be a patron of the arts. He had a passion for these pursuits and had the time and the money to indulge them to his heart's content. And, you know, at that time, if you were going to have a retreat, you were likely going to have it, have a quote unquote cottage in Newport, a 60,000 square foot cottage in Newport, or perhaps something in the Berkshires. You know, you would probably travel to Paris regularly, which George did. But he was down in North Carolina traveling with his mother, and that was actually not that unusual back then because people thought, this is the Blue Ridge Mountains, Smoky Mountains. People thought that the mountain air was curative. So George brought his mom down there. She was being treated by a doctor, and while she was breathing on a porch, he went out on his horse and saw some really beautiful land and then thought, no, this is where I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And so when you talk about that kind of waging battles on marble floors or whatever that author would have said. George just wanted to do something a little different. And I think that because he seemed like such a quiet, private, bookish individual, I imagine that the society in New York could be so claustrophobic and so incestuous. You know, we talk about the 1% today. They talked about the 400 back then, mm-hmm. you know, the number of people who could fit into Carolyn Astor's ballroom. And that just wasn't George's scene. So I think he saw a real opportunity to indulge his love of architecture, art, and kind of, you know, get away from it all.
With the designers, you mentioned Frederick Law Olmsted, who other people may know best for his Central Park design.
Absolutely.
One thing that the Biltmore Estate did before there was even any forestry service was practice proper forestry, not just profitability with lumbering, but conservation, which was especially important before, you know, national parks even became a thing.
Oh, my gosh. One of the things that I hope people who read take away from this, and one of the things I wanted to give a lot of attention to in this book, was Vanderbilt and Biltmore Estate's role in United States forestry history. He brought in two foresters during his, you know, early years. The first one was Gifford Pinchot. He would go on to become the first ever chief of the U.S. Forest Service. And the second one was Carl Schenck, who was a German forester who was familiar with the European approach to forestry, which involved maintaining the health of a forest, relying on native species, reestablishing forests that had been damaged while you were simultaneously lumbering. People here weren't that familiar with it at the time because, you know, we just thought, oh, my gosh, this country's so huge, we're never going to run out of trees. So everybody just kept cutting. You know, so Schenck and George, they needed people to work with him. They said, well, let's start a school of forestry. So they start the Biltmore School of Forestry, and that is the very first school of forestry in the United States of America.
In addition to their forestry school, Edith and George, if we fast forward a bit to now when they're married, they also, you know, in kind of contrast to the opulence that this house, you know, projects, they also did a lot for the community surrounding their house and their grounds. So establishing the church, schools, educational programs, hospitals, you know, how important was it to also show their philanthropic measures in addition to this glorious opulence that is
exactly
this house?
Exactly. Because, yeah, on the one hand, you're like, oh, my God, why write about these just exceedingly rich people? But honestly, we are either approaching or we may have actually surpassed the income disparity that existed during the Gilded Age today. But when you look at people like George and Edith, who, I mean, just you named a few things. They started a school for domestic science that, you know, young women could go to learn how to work in fancy rail cars or in nice homes, giving them jobs. They helped get the YMI off the ground, the Young Men's Institute, which became the Center for African American Culture in Asheville. They built a hospital. They built the parish school for employees' kids and local kids and sent their own daughter there. They built a church. They helped establish the crafts school and eventual business Biltmore Estate Industries. And all of these things, in addition to, you know, the things you might expect from someone at a high level of society, like, you know, found charter members of the American Red Cross and donating to war efforts during World War I and all that sort of stuff. But there was such an intimacy, especially for Edith, the way that she gave. She wasn't just, you know, writing checks. She'd, you know, she would host, you know, the bazaar in the village. She would get on a horse and have a basket with a blanket and food for an employee who was sick or the spouse of an employee who was pregnant. It really endeared them, especially her, to the community. And, you know, honestly, if people with this kind of wealth all behaved that way, the world would be a pretty okay place, I think.
And also Edith had a big role in cementing the relationship with the community after her husband's death. But you have this interesting arc of how she's viewed by the public, you know, starting from coming from a family who was relatively well-known and respected, but not big money necessarily.
Sure.
And kind of a surprise engagement to most people, or they wouldn't find it suitable. So with her striding between the two worlds of Victorian opulence and then coming down to North Carolina for, you know, so-called country living to what the Vanderbilt estate was, what do you think made her and George such a great pair to do this kind of work together?
That's a great question. In many respects, I think
I think they both sort of walk to the beat of their own drummer in a sense. Edith and her sisters, and her brother as well, but he was a little older, suffered some difficult losses early on in their childhood. I think it made her a rather resilient, wouldn't make everyone that, but I think it made her a rather resilient, independent, strong woman. She was raised by essentially, you know, after her familial losses, she was essentially raised by her governess. So I think she felt a real affection for people who did not have that same kind of New York blood lineage that she did. They were so important to her in her life. And George sort of was happy to be away from the New York scene as well. I think they had travel in common. I think they had philanthropy in common. And I think they each had just enough of a, if not desire, satisfaction and ease at living away from the very claustrophobic world of New York society.
To finish up here, I'm going to read you a quote from your book. "So many remnants of that age were already crumbling under the weight of their sumptuous guise, opulence yielding to irrelevance. Biltmore still stands today. It's still owned by the family, but it's welcome to visitors. How has the estate's role changed, and what do you think people should take note of it in today's world?"
It's astounding that it is still standing and that it is still essentially in the same setting it was all the way back then. There might be cars driving around or tour buses and restaurants and that sort of thing, but it is a rare opportunity to actually kind of immerse yourself in a very, very different time. It's easy to get distracted by that, not distracted by the house. The house is, you know, one of the main reasons people go there. But I would encourage them to not just look at the extremely gorgeous gardens and fountains and things surrounding the estate itself. But if you go down there, go into the village that once housed people who worked there and the Cathedral of All Souls that George had built for the community, and go a little further afield and go into Pisgah National Forest and look at some waterfalls and enjoy some solitude, because if they had not rejuvenated those forests and protected them, you wouldn't be able to do that. So I always tell people the house is great. The setting is amazing. I'm a huge believer in how significant it is historically. But go a little further afield and see the legacy of what they didn't build.
Well, your book is certainly a good start if they can't make it directly to that location. Denise Kiernan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Denise Kiernan is the author of The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. She talked with Audrey Nowakowski, who shared a photo of her with her family at Biltmore from, let's say, several years back. You can see it at WUWM.com. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. That's all for today's edition of Lake Effect. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.